You're listening to Federal Prison Authority Presents Around the Block with Bruce Cameron and Susan Giddings, only on LA Talk Radio.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to our program. I'm Bruce Cameron, along with Susan Giddings, and we are going to share some very important concepts today. Some of the, I guess, if you will, underpinning parts of the First Step Act. I know you guys are wanting to hear that. These are things that need to be discussed because they're so important, and they get overlooked, and they get confused with other things, with custody and security, and that's not what it means, and stuff like that. But Susan is going to clearly articulate all those concepts and also differentiate that for us. So without further ado, Susan, what's going on over there?
Yeah, so, you know, we haven't talked about just pattern and the Spark 13 in a long time on the show. You know, we do cover it in our book, and if you do not have Unlocking Federal Time Credits, second edition, I'm going to recommend it. We have a separate chapter on both pattern and on the Spark 13, and we actually go through information on all of the different elements, and we're going to talk about all of that today. But I thought it would be beneficial, a little bit of backstory on it. I know I can't tell you how many times I see the post, oh, it passed in 2018, and here we are in, you know, seven years later, and they're still making changes. Well, some of that was actually part of the law itself. So kind of understanding the process and what was actually built into the law. So when the law passed, one of the things that was in there is it gave the Department of Justice, not the Bureau, but the Department of Justice, the Attorney General, 210 days to put together this risk and need assessment systems that are spelled out as part of the system. And of course, you know, we all know that in order to earn 15 days, you got to be lower minimum risk, recidivism risk level. Well, guess what? That didn't exist when the law was passed. So the first step was they literally had to develop this system. Now, interestingly, and I say interestingly because I feel like it's part of the complication of the law, essentially, the Department of Justice had to work with the National Institute of Justice, and an independent review committee was put together, and they had individuals from different subject matter experts in terms of state DOCs, universities, and other entities, and all kind of came together to discuss and debate how do we come up with a risk and need assessment system. Now, risk and need assessment systems or risk assessment, recidivism risk assessments aren't new. Probation, federal probation has one that it's called the PICRA. And when a new person comes in, they go through this assessment process, and it kind of identifies both the level of risk that they are to recidivate and the amount of services to meet that risk. You know, can they be a once a month report, or do they need to have like regular updates, right? Regular reporting. So they looked at all of this. You look like you want to jump in and ask a question.
Yeah, yeah. Just for those who are like this is an academic thing. Some of this is all born out of the research and risk assessment. And the first thing being the risk needs responsivity. It's called R&R. And a lot of what Susan's going to be talking about, a lot about what the Bureau put into these instruments, is literally culled out of some of the empirical data on the risk needs responsivity kind of paradigm. The other paradigm, or the other assessment out there that we use in the mental health world, if you will, and certain forms of treatment world, is a level of service inventory. Again, that also talks about living conditions, neighbors, quality of relationships, family contact. So some of these things that we see in FSA programming, some of these things we're going to see in the SPARK 13 and others are from that greater body of research. So for those of you that are so inclined to Google RNR or risk needs responsivity or level of service, you can do that. Then you can kind of really understand, I think, some of the underpinnings behind what Susan is going to say.
Absolutely.
Is applied.
In fact, the level of service inventory actually has a recidivism specific assessment tool, and that was actually one of the ones that this independent review committee looked at, was the LSIR, among other things, Compass and some other ones that are out there. And so they came together. Now, the interesting, from my perspective, as I started to say, was the Bureau's custody classification instrument is a recidivism risk instrument. It is designed to predict the risk of violence, misconduct within a 12-month period, right? And as so annually an individual is updated and they look at, is there risk coming up, going up, or is it coming down? And based on that, they are able to move from, say, higher secure facilities to lower secure facilities, or vice versa, because they had issues and they moved up. So the Bureau, the technical name for the Bureau's instrument is BRAVO. And it is, I looked this up so I would have the right answer. It is the Bureau Risk Assessment Verification and Observation Instrument. So one of the things that the researchers did when they started pulling together this data was the Bureau provided a whole bunch of numbers for a whole bunch of folks who had been previously incarcerated. And they used that as kind of their base to start looking at it. And what they found was the BRAVO tool, when applied to recidivism, is actually a very good tool. In fact, when they compared it to what, and this is a academic term, the AUC, the area under the curve, that is a statistical measure. BRAVO actually was better than a number of other instruments, including the LSIR, PCRA, Compass, etc. Now, the Bureau also, because they understood in terms of recidivism, they actually customized their existing BRAVO instrument into what they refer to as the BRAVO R, specifically looking at modifying that instrument to predict recidivism. And the primary difference between the BRAVO and the BRAVO R was, and I had it written down and I don't see it in my notes, so we won't worry about it, but it was detainers. They removed detainers. They removed percentage of time served, which is more a function of misconduct issues, and then the severity of offenses. That's what it was. And they found that while the BRAVO, when applied to recidivism risk, was actually pretty effective, the BRAVO R was even more effective. But the powers to be decided, we want to do something better. What can we do? So they looked at all of these instruments. They got feedback from different state systems and private organizations that do risk assessment in the communities. And they came together with what we now today lovingly refer to as PATTERN. And PATTERN is the Prisoner Risk Assessment Tool Targeting Estimated Risk and Need. That's what it stands for. Now, the funny part to this is people hear need and they go, oh, this is the need assessment. It isn't. This need is different than the SPARK 13 need. We actually talk about this in the book. And we'll get into it when we talk more about the SPARK 13. But this need refers to that level of services. Someone who is high risk needs more services. Someone who is low risk needs less services. The risk assessment tool, or I'm sorry, the need assessment tool that the law actually talks about is a different assessment in terms of criminogenic needs. We'll talk about that later in the show. So they came up with this, they tested it, and based on the elements they were including, which were very similar, but there were some differences. between the Bravo R and what the initial pattern looked like, it did perform better. And what they found is they were able to get, depending on whether it was male or female or general or violent, they were able to get a 1 to 3% improvement, which is not a lot, but in the world of research,
that's pretty good.
1 to 3% is still good. Very good.
Absolutely.
So again, saw improvement, that's what they ran with. So when we talk about the risk and need assessment system, so let's hit on some of the components of it. I will tell you, the original risk and need assessment system that rolled out in 2019 is not the same that we're using today. Today we are using version 1.3. Back then, obviously, it was 1.1, so there's been improvements on it. The focus has been they want to make sure that it is predicting risk accurately across the various racial, ethnic, and sex groups, right? They want to make sure that we're accurately predicting for males and females, as well as whites, blacks, Hispanic, Asian, Native American, males and females. So that's a lot of things that they're looking at. They do a revalidation annually. Interestingly, we haven't seen the 2024 report. The 2023 report, well, I should say it's a 24, it was published in 2024, but it was 2023 data, came out in June of 2024. We are now at December of 2025. We have not seen either any kind of annual revalidation for pattern or for the Spark 13 or for just the general Department of Justice annual report, which is a requirement of the law. So that's very interesting. Perhaps the shutdown interfered with that, but usually they were coming out in somewhere between mid to late summer. So I would have expected to see it already. Hopefully we see it soon. But the current instrument, as a lot of folks know, has both a general and a violent score. Individuals get scored minimum, low, medium, or high on both the general assessment and on the violent assessment. What are those assessing? General risk of recidivism and then risk of violent recidivism. There are separate scoring mechanisms for males and females. And it is different and it is confusing. Folks will say, we hear it all the time about, well, I'm medium but I'm in a camp, or I'm in a camp and I'm medium. I don't understand, you know, and we have to explain that difference in security level versus recidivism risk level. The problem is there's a lot of overlap between the two. So when you're looking at what you're being scored for, it's easy to become confused. And that's, we have folks that are in penitentiaries that have brought their recidivism risk level down. So that's what's important to pay attention to. So very quickly, we're just going to go through those elements that are assessed. Current age. Crime is a young man's game. The older you are, the less likely you are to get in trouble. That's just the statistics of it, right? Crime of violence. Crime of violence, if you're incarcerated for a crime of violence, you are at a higher risk. Criminal history points. This is a huge one, and it has a horribly difficult impact on folks. Criminal history points don't change. Unlike history of violence and history of escape that get older, criminal history points are static. What you got when you were in court is what you carry for your entire term of incarceration. This is true both with pattern and with the custody classification instrument. And I know this is a kind of a point of contention. Got had an opportunity to do some training with, present some training to federal public defenders a few years ago while I was still working. And this issue of the criminal history points being static is a big issue. And I can appreciate the where they're coming from. For someone who is serving 10, 15, 20 years, and you are being held to the same criminal history points you were being held to when you walked in the door.
Yeah.
is difficult.
Right. So in the world of risk, you have static risk factors and dynamic risk factors. And static risk factors don't change. That's like hair color.
By definition, my hair color.
Eye color. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah. This one changes. But yeah, eye color or other types of things. But so anyway, and that's frustrating because that may be more of a dynamic variable in its application. So
right. So history of escape, history of violence scored into both. Education score. This one is interesting because it's only worth on custody classification, it's only 1 or 2 points. In recidivism, it actually can lower, for someone who doesn't have their high school diploma, it can lower your recidivism score by 6 points on their general. It means it's got a pretty decent bump to it. But this is something that we see when we're talking about pre-sentence investigation reports and making sure that information is accurate in the report. That delay, if you have your high school diploma and it is not verified in the PSR, that delay is the difference between, you know, coming in and start earning, having points, time credits applied against your sentence and not. And it's not like 6 or 7 months later you get your GED or your high school diploma verified, that the Bureau goes back and goes, oh, okay, well, we're giving you credit back to the beginning. No, it is, you get credit starting when it's been verified. So very important topic there. Drug programming. For those that have substance abuse history less than 5 years old, participation in the non-residential drug abuse program and the residential drug abuse program has a positive impact. The RDAP program obviously grants more points than non-res does. But depending on how old the substance abuse history is, if it's more than 5 years, participating in the program doesn't create a positive impact. I mean, it does in terms of programming,
right.
But the lowest score that you can get in terms of substance abuse is none or more than 5 years. So the mitigation, the improved scoring that happens with the non-res and the RDAP program are based on individuals whose substance abuse history is less than 5 years old. Because once it's more than 5 years old, the participating in the programming doesn't help it. Okay. That doesn't mean, and when we get to the Spark 13, that doesn't necessarily mean that you're not still needing to participate in programming, based on the need assessment, because it's still there. This is, again, talking about that risk element. Course misconduct is going to be scored. Bad behavior is bad behavior, whether it's an incident report or it's new criminal conduct. So incident reports are always scored. The scoring, though, varies. It's scored based on all incident reports, as well as seriousness of the incident reports, also the recency of the incident reports. So misconduct has just a huge impact. And of course, everybody walks in the door with clear conduct.
All right.
So again, in terms of the recidivism risk, misconduct can only hurt you because you walk in the door, you're clear conduct.
Right.
FRP refuse status. Not surprising, FRP refuse status is an example of non-compliance. And like misconduct or new criminal behavior, non-compliance is non-compliance.
Is FRP a program?
FRP is an official productive activity. So not only does it hurt your pattern risk assessment level, it will also put you into opt-out status.
Yes.
And then the last two elements have to do with programs. Separately, general programming, so parenting is included here, drug education is included here, adult continuing education, a number of the mental residential mental health programs count here, and then the vocational programs. Vocational programs include UniCorps employment, apprenticeships, VT classes, all of those things, those skill building, but work specific skill building classes. So pattern is scored every single time a person goes to team. As the individual sitting here, and you and I have talked to family members, we talk to clients that are heading to prison, by policy, case managers are required to provide an individual with a copy of that pattern risk assessment at every team. And at the bottom of that pattern risk assessment, the number at the bottom of it is the list of programs that they have completed that are being credited toward pattern, because not all programs get credited. And it's important that folks review their pattern risk assessment. They look at the programs that are listed. If they're looking at it and they know they've completed drug education and it's not there, they need to be talking to their case manager, particularly if they're not lower minimum. If you're lower minimum, you're lower minimum. But if you're one of those folks that you're sitting at medium, and that 1 point for a program can make the difference in dropping from medium to low and therefore getting to apply your credit, don't just assume that everything's fine. And it could be something as simple as you completed drug education last Friday, brand new. Right. You're coming to team, it's Monday. Well, your case manager probably did not pull that pattern worksheet this morning.
Right.
They probably pulled it a couple of days ago. So again, you look at that worksheet. If you are missing something, you need to be bringing it up right there. Very, very important. We've talked about some of the self-advocacy things in previous shows, and we talk about it in our book. You know, hiring us is helpful. We're going to guide you through it. We're going to advocate for you, but it's your life and you've got to be directly involved in it. Interesting. We mentioned, the fact that we haven't seen this year's reports yet. This year's reports, I'm a little bit of a geek. I was personally looking forward to this new report, because this year's report will be the first year with actual pattern data. Every report that has been pulled previously has been pulled by pulling together those reports from other areas. Pattern is not generated by the case manager entering data into it. Pattern is generated by extracting data from different places, from custody classification, from the education record, from the disciplinary record, pulling all of that together into one document. So this cohort that would be being used to validate will be the first one that actually used actual pattern data. Right. So I was very much looking forward to it. But I did notice in looking at the 2024 report that the AUC number actually is a little lower on the 1.3 than it was on the 1.1. And this is a function of, again, they're trying to make sure that the racial disparities are pulled out of it. And we can't ethically, legally, you can't say, well, we're making these adjustments, and if you're this from this racial group, you're going to get a -2. And if you're in this racial group, you're going to get a +3. And if you're from here, you're going to get a -1. And if you're female, but you're going to get a -3 if you're male. We're not allowed to do that. So they keep working with the points that are assigned to the individual elements, as well as the cut points, to try to get to a point where the prediction of what the tool says will happen matches what did happen. Okay. And because all recidivism research is retrospective, it's already happened. So we're looking back. And, but I do find it interesting that the the latest data had the AUC curve was actually lower in terms of predictability than the first edition of Pattern, as well as the Bravo and Bravo R. Very interesting. But we'll have to see what the new report says.
Are you saying as a function of time, it's being less effective?
I am. Okay. I mean, I don't know if DOJ or the Bureau or anyone else would say that. But yeah, the numbers are there. You know, when you look at...
So it almost makes you wonder if the underlying construct is changing.
Possibly. Possibly. So, So the June of 2024 report, when it did a 1, 2, and 3 year recidivism numbers, right? Mm-hmm. It ranged in terms of effectiveness between 7.45 and 7.76, which is still very good. Don't get me wrong. But the original numbers, what we were looking at is between 7.7 and 8.0. So the top end now, what was the bottom end in terms of effectiveness on Pattern 1.1 is now the top end of Pattern 1.3. It's kind of interesting. Like I said, it'll be very good to see the new data and see what that changes, but only if you're a geek like me. Information, everything I've talked about, you can find on the Bureau's website. If you go to the FSA page with all the resources, you will see DOJ reports, and on there covers the annual reports as well as the recidivism, pattern recidivism scores.
I just want to say categorically that I'm glad that they borrowed from the empirical research on this. Yeah, there's a little bit of slippage in some numbers, but folks, these are still really good risk instruments. Nobody that I know of, and Susan and I are both trained researchers, but nobody has taken pot shots saying, oh, you're using invalid stuff. No, man. I mean, so people are kind of like, you know what? You guys did your homework. You're doing the best that you can. And so I think that while nobody likes to live by their number or their categorical variable of low or medium or whatever, but these are still pretty much the best in the industry.
Right. And the reality is, you know, risk assessments are never going to be perfect because they're just a number. They're a good guess, but they're still a guess. And we're still dealing with human beings. And human beings can defy the odds positively or negatively every single day. So we're going to shift gears at this point, and we're going to talk about the Spark 13. Not a lot of attention gets paid to this, as far as I'm concerned. Not enough attention gets paid to this. If you look at, again, those DOJ reports, a lot of energy was spent in talking about the pattern risk assessment and how it was going to be done, and these groups of people coming together to talk about the different instruments that are out there and everything else. The same level of public exposure did not happen. The reality is it just didn't have the same people were focused on the risk recidivism because the risk level was what was tied to time credits.
Right.
That's not to say people weren't talking about the needs assessment, what ultimately became the Spark 13. Other than the law saying dyslexia needed to be included, which funnily enough, dyslexia is not a criminogenic need. We'll talk more about that in a second, but just, I think more work needs to be done. I'll say that that way. More work needs to be done with the Spark 13. The report, the last validation report, I was pleasantly surprised to see it posted to the public website. I had obviously was working at the time and saw it in draft, but I retired and nothing came out. And at some point it got posted. But like I said, we're now more than a year out from when it was finished. It was, it should have been, it should have been posted back summer to fall of 2024. And it is, it wasn't. So let's talk about the Spark 13. Again, its official name, because, you know, we have to have really fun acronyms, is Standardized Prisoner Assessment for Reducing Criminality. And the 13, that's the Spark part. And the 13 is the 13 need assessments. So the Spark 13 is not one cohesive, unified need assessment tool. It is, in fact, 13 different things. Some of them, yes.
As I say, in the MMPI, which is a 500 question personality test, we'll take what's called critical items that will then load up statistically. And so this is Spark is critical items, right? That have been
in theory
identified.
In theory it is. And when you look at the list, they make sense. So let's just really quickly go through the list. Anger and hostility makes sense if you don't have control of your anger issues. Antisocial peers, if you hang around with problem children, you're likely to be a problem child. For those of us who are parents, we relate to this one very well. Education, dyslexia. And I remember I already said dyslexia is not a criminogenic need, but it was required as part of the law. I am guessing there was a congressman or senator who had experienced, maybe with a family member, maybe with a child, the issue of dyslexia and being not diagnosed and the impact on educational experience. Okay.
I wonder if being on the spectrum will be on there next.
That would be interesting. Just, interesting. Yeah. That's a whole, probably a whole show on its own.
Sure is. Go ahead.
Family and parenting. And this is another one that's interesting. We'll come back to it. Finance poverty, not a criminogenic need. It is a responsivity characteristic. And as Bruce mentioned, the notion of the R&R model, we too talk about and explain the R&R model in our book. But responsivity has to do with kind of the where the person is in terms of being receptive to treatment. And the notion of including finance poverty as part of that responsivity factor is if you are, regardless, forget being releasing from custody, if you're in the community, if you have needs and you are struggling to just stay housed, pay rent, keep the lights on, put food on the table, if you are struggling with those basic needs, you really don't have the bandwidth to be focused on these other areas of improvement because you are doing all you can to keep your head above water. So it is a very important factor. Medical and mental health, these are also responsivity factors, right? In terms of if you're having a lot of medical issues, that's where your focus is. You're not worried about who you're hanging out with or your anger issues. You're focused on my medical needs, right? Mm-hmm. Rec, leisure, fitness. Now, I personally have a bone to pick with this one, with the Bureau and how they implemented it. And not a secret at all. We talk about it, I think, in the book. I was invited to collaborate on another article specifically on the Spark 13, and I addressed this. The Bureau focuses on the fitness in rec, leisure, fitness. Okay. And the instrument, what they're using to assess it is what's called chronic care clinics. So if you have high blood pressure, if you have high cholesterol, those are the two that, if you're diabetic, right? Mm-hmm. Those are chronic care clinics. Those have a correlation to fitness, right? Those are all chronic medical conditions that with better fitness routines and losing weight and eating right, doing all those good things, you can kind of turn the corner on those. But in terms of criminogenic needs, actually the issue is rec and leisure. It is about how you spend your free time. Do you have hobbies? Do you participate in sports? Do you have clubs you belong to? Do you know how to use your free time in a pro-social, positive way, as opposed to hanging out on the corner, dropping rocks off bridges, doing other things that are going to get you in trouble? And again, I always used to say being a case manager was good training for being a parent and vice versa. You know, when our kids were little, what did we do? We kept them busy, because if they were busy, they didn't have time to get in trouble. Same concept. So that's another one. Trauma. For a lot of organizations, the Bureau uses what's called ACEs, and that is an assessment of childhood traumatic experiences. The research shows that trauma in childhood carries a person, stays with a person into adulthood, and kind of informs decision making and behaviors. And so trauma is one of those areas. And again, I would say that the Bureau falls a little short in this, because they focus on ACE, on the childhood experiences. But I would argue there are adult experiences that are not necessarily captured, and we'll talk about, or not captured maybe specifically enough. Substance abuse history, we've touched on that already with the pattern. Obviously, the impact of substance abuse in terms of criminal behavior is a kind of a straight line. Cognition is about how we think, and how based on how we think kind of dictates how we make decisions and how we act, and that gap between thinking and acting and kind of processing that. Bruce, you probably can speak more to cognition than me.
And problem solving was a big part of that.
Absolutely.
Cognition piece, yeah.
Right. And so, then the last area is work. And that's going toward not just working and having a job, but having the skill set. But more importantly, and again, this is an area I feel like the Bureau falls short a little bit on this, is how satisfying is work? Do you enjoy what you do? People who enjoy what they do work-wise, who are having a positive work experience, because think about it, if we're employed full-time, that's 40-plus hours of our life. And if we are satisfied in our work experience, then that satisfaction carries out into how we deal with people, how we deal with stressful situations, et cetera. So there's some really interesting connections. Now, I will say in the Bureau's defense, we're limited in how we assess work. What do we use? We use the pre-sentence investigation report, right? And what is the pre-sentence investigation report telling us? It's going to tell us about, did the person work? Did they have a job? Was it full-time or part-time? Right. How long we were there? As long as the person wasn't fired, right? Or maybe if they quit and in their interview, they told the probation officer they quit because their boss was a jerk and was always yelling at them, right? That may or may not get included. So how can the Bureau assess that work-life satisfaction, which is really what the criminogenic need issue kind of goes to? Same thing with education. The Bureau assesses, do you have a high school diploma or not, or a GED, a high school equivalent? But it's more about, again, that school experience. How was school? Did the person enjoy school? And I'm not saying you got to love going to school, but were you miserable? Were you bullied right. in school? Which kind of then overlaps with that trauma thing.
Right. Or so, were you truant, or did you get in trouble in school? But yes.
Did you get in trouble? Did you graduate it, but just barely, you know?
Right.
Those kinds of things. And again, the Bureau is limited to what they have in the pre-sentence investigation report. Interestingly, the article that I collaborated on with some federal probation officers, retired probation officers, was getting to just that thing, is what if probation was asking these questions as part of the pre-sentence investigation report and was collecting that information, understanding what that the Bureau is going to use it if it's there. It'll be, you know, I know there's several probation officers kind of involved in that. There's a number of districts that are starting to do trauma assessments and including that information, doing an ACES assessment, including that in their pre-sentence investigation report. So it's kind of interesting where this dynamic is going, even though it started with FSA and the First Step Act and the Bureau, is what kind of repercussions kind of going backwards to probation and that pretrial experience and what information they include. So that'll be super interesting to see where that goes. Couple of mechanics in terms of Spark 13. So person walks in the door, brand new to the Bureau. They are going to complete the anger, hostility, antisocial peers, cognition, and family parenting assessments. Those are self-assessments. They are, once they get their access to TrueLinks and they can log into the electronic bulletin board system, they'll be able to pull those down, answer every question. Don't skip any.
Even if the
options, the ABC options are like not exactly, pick the closest ones. Don't skip something. Complete them all.
Yes.
The needs assessment like pattern is to be generated at every single team. And like the pattern, the incarcerated person is required to get a copy of it. Now, there's less information on that. It's just telling you if you went from yes to no or no to yes. The primary movers in terms of going from no to yes is misconduct. So let's hypothetically say you answer the questions and you score out as you do not have a need in the anger hostility area. And so your need no. And then you get into a fight. You are now need yes. So the primary driver to flipping it to yes, you do have a need is misconduct, right? The primary driver flipping it to no is program completion. Right. And the programs that satisfy need areas are not necessarily the same that change pattern. Two different sets we do talk about in the book. We actually provide in the book a list of the programs that impact pattern. Go ahead. Yes.
And yes, also, so we're talking retrospectively with a lot of this stuff, but just be advised that your institutional conduct does matter as well. Like some things could get worse. For instance, fighting, cell phones, right?
Could negatively impact things. Yeah, absolutely.
Drug use. Okay.
Drug use. So right, yes,
just wanted to make,
misconduct is bad all the way across the board. It is never a good thing. Just saying. So you've got the four self-assessments. Another important thing to remember during intake, and you might not be thinking about this, during intake, when you walk in the door, they are going to give you, when you're sitting there in R&D, you're going to get a whole stack of paper and you're going to be filling out a bunch of paper. One of those papers is a psychology services intake questionnaire. It's a PSIQ. That's shorthand. Psychology services intake questionnaire. It is two-sided. The backside of it is your trauma assessment. It is the ACES questions. And the very last one says, and it has a whole list of things that, have you experienced any of these as an adult? And that's the only question they have in terms of adult trauma, which is why I personally have a little issue with it, but that's just me. But if we have had clients who didn't get the piece of paper, because when they went through the stack, somebody just missed putting that piece of paper in the stack. We had a client that answered the front side and didn't realize there was a back side. And we had another client who skipped some of the questions, wasn't sure how to answer them and skipped them. And in all three cases, they did not start earning their time credits because the institution was like, oh, well, it's not complete. Now, you would think that someone in psychology would go, hey, they missed the backside. We should put them on call out and have them come over here and finish it. They didn't. Maybe they should have, I would argue they should have, but it didn't happen. So that's something else. So that you need to remember. The other assessments are completed as a function of file reviews by staff. So there's nothing the individual needs to do. The only other issue is on dyslexia. It is a two-step review. There's a screening. And then if the education staff believe there could be an issue, they're going to put the person on call out to come over to education and do some screening, do some additional testing. If a person is called over to education to do the screening and they're like, yeah, no, I don't want to do any kind of testing, that is a refuse that will automatically put you in opt-out status. And I know this is difficult, having family members with learning disabilities to include dyslexia. You know, when you went through school and school was a struggle and school was a negative experience, and now you're being asked to do more tests, that's kind of triggering. It's doesn't put you in a good mindset, and your instinct is to say no and pull back.
Four minutes.
So that covers all of the needs assessment. Again, 13 of them. They are reviewed each time you come to team. A person comes to team. Each time, unit team should provide you a copy. And if they don't, ask for it. It's going to give you information about the yeses and nos. And why do you want to know about the yeses and nos? Because if you do not have a need in a given area and you don't want to take a program, you don't have to. You can decline it without any negative impact. If your need, no. If you are need, yes, and you decline a program as recommended, you are now in opt-out status. You are no longer getting programming days. You are not getting time credits. Right. And that is a wrap. Do you have any other comments, questions you want to jump in on?
I mean, no, not, well.
You got
a little. Here's a little thing on risk.
Ah!
The x-axis is time and the y-axis is risk. And let's say somebody here is higher risk, but as a function of time, if they go risk behavior free, right, the risk goes down towards zero. It never reaches zero. If right. Susan and I took a risk thing today, it would never be zero, right? It would be very low risk or low risk. So it's just interesting to know that how important time is, things that are 10 years old or 20 years old, and how important time is in the risk nomenclature. So just
absolutely. And again, as long as you're not engaging in new negative behavior, misconduct, as long as you're not engaging in new negative behavior, your risk level is going to come down. Bruce said, it's just a function of time, which is going back to the comment we made about criminal history score, which is why there are those out there that are like, hey, shouldn't we look at criminal history score in the context of time? Right. And there's some arguments to be made to support that.
Yep.
So
there are.
But again, that is a wrap. We've covered the fundamentals. Yep. Again, they are veiled. We go into great detail in the book, Green Book, Unlocking Federal Time Credits, second edition. We also go into and talk about the risk need responsivity model, just as a general kind of academic discussion. Bye.
You're listening to Federal Prison Authority Presents Around the Block with Bruce Cameron and Susan Giddings, only on LA Talk Radio.